The Tom Woods Show, episode 2153.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey folks, if you've decided it's best not to have your kids educated by people who have declared war on you, then consider the self-taught Ron Paul curriculum. Instructors like me will give your kids an unfair advantage and an education you and I could only have dreamed of. But make sure you join through my link, because only there do you get my $160 worth of free bonuses. My link is ronpaulhomeschool.com. Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here. I want to resume my coverage of the Federal Reserve System today, which I interrupted with the episode about the terrible tragedy with Gret Glier. Tomorrow on the program, I'm going to be talking to Kevin Gutzman and Brian McClanahan, a couple of great U.S. historians, about what's been going on in the courts. Of course, the Roe versus Wade issue and the overturning of it, the gun case. We're going to talk about these things, do an episode on them. So that's coming up. But I want to dive back into this episode. And even if you missed the previous one, doesn't matter, because all these episodes are completely self-contained. And I want to start off this episode exactly where I left off last time, because last time I ended by talking about some of the arguments that are made in favor of the Fed. Now, of course, some of the arguments are ones that we covered in the episode 2151, which namely are things like they've smoothed out the business cycle, and so economic downturns aren't as severe as they used to be. And so we handled that. But they also say that if it weren't for the Fed, then prices would be falling consistently, and this would have bad macroeconomic effects. They argue that a growing economy, you've sometimes heard this, and maybe some of you even have bought into this at one time or another, that a growing economy can function only if the supply of money grows along with it. But this is a fallacy that David Ricardo refuted 200 years ago. Any supply of money can facilitate any number of transactions. So if the supply of goods and services doubles, we don't need, and it would actually be disruptive, to double the supply of money along with it. Prices just fall by half. And so the same supply of money can purchase the entire supply of goods. Until the early 20th century, by the way, during peacetime anyway, prices fell consistently throughout American history. And I realize this will come as a surprise to most Americans, because we're all accustomed to seeing consumer prices rise over time. And so we just sort of assume that's the way things work. Things just get more expensive inexplicably. And that just leads to a wave of price increases throughout the economy, as if this is some fixed aspect of the universe and we just have to learn to live with it. But it isn't. Under hard money, and by hard money, we mean money that can't be inflated away. So generally, we're talking about precious metals when we use that expression. Under hard money, the supply of money grows relatively slowly, and the supply of other goods and services increases more rapidly. And by the way, if you're wondering, well, why does that have to be? Well, the very reason that we choose these particular things as money is that their supply increases only very slowly, if at all. That's the reason they get chosen. That's, or at least that's a reason they get chosen in the first place. And so with goods other than money more abundant with respect to money, then their prices fall. Now, we're told today this would be a terrible situation, just terrible, if consumer prices fell and were expected to continue falling, no one would ever buy anything. We'd all be sitting back waiting for prices to fall even more. So we wouldn't go have a cup of coffee, because the cup of coffee maybe costs $1.50. And we know that if we wait till tomorrow, it'll be $1.48. Well, okay, but you just want the coffee, right? At some point, you just want. So, but this argument is used that if prices are expected to continue falling, nobody would buy, because we would sit back waiting for still more declines in prices. So only on our deathbeds, presumably, as we're taking in our last breaths, would we frantically grasp an iPhone, you know, or a paperback book, or a new leather jacket or something. Since for us, because we're about to die, there would at last be no more tomorrow on which prices could keep falling. Now, if this crazy theory weren't constantly repeated, we wouldn't have to spend any time refuting it. But remember, our talking heads consider it to be their job to warn us of the unthinkable scenarios that would arise if we were not carefully supervised by our self-sacrificing public servants. Now, it is true, obviously, people prefer lower prices to higher ones. But it's also true that they value goods in the present more highly than they do the same goods in the future. And this factor offsets the desire to wait indefinitely for a lower price. A candy bar today is more serviceable to a consumer than is a candy bar available only 2, 10, or 400 years from now, even if the candy bar will be cheaper then. Sane people don't refuse to purchase a $1 cup of coffee because they expect the price to fall to 95 cents 3 years from now. We might take as an example of this, by the way, personal computers. Their prices have steadily fallen at the same time that their quality has risen. What has that meant? That nobody buys computers because they know that tomorrow it'll be cheaper and the day after that it'll be cheaper? Have we all just stoically awaited still further declines in price? Or have, in fact, a few of us broken down and actually purchased a computer? Well, then we get told that falling prices must threaten business profitability and even lead to mass bankruptcies. How can business firms survive, we're told, if the selling prices of their goods suddenly fall? All right, well, that's an objection. Here's how you answer it. If the deflation, and we're talking about price deflation, if price is going down, if the deflation is anticipated, there's no problem. I mean, that's the job of the entrepreneur. He's supposed to anticipate the prices at which he can profitably sell his products in the future. Don't worry about him. That's his job. It's his job to anticipate this. So businesses will remain just as profitable as they would have been if prices had risen or stayed the same, as long as they anticipated those outcomes also. So if business firms expect prices to fall by the time they bring their goods to market, then therefore they're going to be willing to pay less in the present for all the inputs, for all the factors of production. In other words, the resources that are employed to produce goods and services. All these things they need to produce their goods, they'll just pay less for. They'll be willing to pay less for. So if a general fall in prices is expected, then suppliers of these factors of production are going to have no choice but to accept these lower bids for their goods and services, since nobody's going to be able to afford to continue buying inputs from them at the old higher price level and still stay profitable. And so an expected fall in consumer prices is factored in to the prices that business firms pay for the goods they use as inputs, and that thereby maintains profitability for these firms even in the face of falling prices. So, for example, a widget company may pay $10 in inputs for every widget it produces and then be able to sell each of these widgets to the public for $15. But suppose prices begin to fall and widgets are expected to sell for only $9 instead of $15 by the time they're ready to be brought to market next year. Well, now the widget manufacturer can afford to continue producing widgets only if he can acquire his inputs for, say, $6 instead of the previous $10. If he can do so, then he will still make a profit, even in this deflationary environment. There will still be a positive spread between his sales revenues and his costs. But if, as is the case in a general deflation, all prices are falling, suppliers will have no choice but to cut prices, which they can indeed do, since their own costs will be falling given the general fall in prices. Production will continue profitably as before. Now, what if the deflation is unanticipated? In that case, some firms will find themselves unable to sell their product at a price that will bring them an adequate return, and they may even suffer losses because the prices they can fetch for their products, thanks to the deflation, are lower than they expected them to be. In effect, they find that they had paid too much for the factors of production to leave them with a profit in light of the lower prices they can now charge for their products. So for that reason, the result of unanticipated deflation for a given firm could very well be bankruptcy. The firm would then wind up in bankruptcy court, where reorganization of the firm or the sale and distribution of its assets to its creditors in order of seniority takes place. Now, if the assets are sold off, then they're just shifted from one production process to another, but they continue in use. So if the firm continues in operation, but under new ownership, as the firm's creditors take the reins, then its previous production process likewise continues as before. So bankruptcy, yes, is very unfortunate for a particular firm, but it is of no significance to the economy in the aggregate. It does not matter to economic activity who the particular owners of firms happen to be. If ownership changes hands from one group of people to another as the result of bankruptcy proceedings, this does not matter from the point of view of the economy as a whole. From the economy's perspective, nothing has changed. Production continues as before. Now, as we're going to see later, either in this episode or a future one, central bank inflation or Fed inflation that pumps money into the banking system and pushes interest rates down gives rise to an artificial economic boom that distorts the structure of production and encourages the creation or expansion of sectors of the economy that will have to contract or close down when the inevitable bust comes along. These kinds of inflation-fueled distortions do not occur in a deflationary environment. The worst that could happen from the point of view of production is a series of hiccups, minor and temporary interruptions, while bankruptcy courts sort out questions of ownership and compensation. Now, critics will reply that, okay, deflation is a terrible fate to be avoided because firms who are loaded with debt will find those debts harder to pay back. So, for example, $1 million loan contracted 5 years ago is more difficult to repay today if the dollar is now worth more and is thus now harder to come by. So now it's harder to get that $1 million you need to pay back because each one of those $1 million is now worth more because prices are lower and the dollar can command more. So this is the converse of a debt being easier to pay over time if the dollar has lost value during the period of the loan. But the response to this would be as follows. For one thing, banks can simply renegotiate the debt in light of the money's increased purchasing power. The banks don't necessarily want to seize your assets and hold on to them because a lot of your assets are illiquid. They really don't want to be sitting on those. So a lot of times they'll just renegotiate the debt in light of the changed conditions. But even if banks insisted on the payment of the debt in the agreed upon number of nominal dollars, then again, we're faced with the problem of bankruptcy, which that's a problem for an individual firm, but it's not an economy-wide problem. So once again, new owners take over, production continues as before. And by the way, who says heavy debt and high leverage are the best means for financing a business firm? Why should we artificially encourage debt like this? Maybe it would be better, especially in light of the private debt levels of recent years, to have a system that encourages firms to finance themselves with equity rather than more and more debt. And finally, we might note that deflation, contrary to what we often hear, has not, in fact, been associated with economic depression in history. According to a 2004 study in the American Economic Review, which examined data from around the world, quote, the data suggest that deflation is not closely related to depressions. A broad historical look finds more periods of deflation with reasonable growth than with depression, and many more periods of depression with inflation than with deflation. Overall, the data show virtually no link between deflation and depression, unquote. Now, there's much more that both sides can say about deflation, but this simple analysis should at least be enough to make you suspect that a fall in prices may not be the end of the world after all. But if that's true, then why all the hysteria about deflation, hysteria we never hear with respect to inflation? All right, well, think about who suffers most during deflation. One victim is the government, because the government is always in debt in the modern era, and it has a much harder time servicing that debt when it has to repay debt holders with more valuable dollars than it borrowed. Another victim during deflation is the array of financial firms on Wall Street that have arranged their debt-based investment strategies in the Fed-inspired expectation of ongoing price inflation. When these firms suddenly find they need to repay short-term debt in more valuable dollars than they borrowed, their debt-fueled house of cards comes crashing down. So note that some of the most powerful and influential forces in society, those that benefit most from cheap money and who get the newly created money before anyone else, are the ones most hurt by deflation. Everyone else benefits from falling prices and therefore higher real incomes. And so more to the point, those people who suffered from the inflation, not just those on fixed incomes, but also the general run of the population, and who wound up paying higher prices for everything they bought, now benefit from the increase in the dollar's value and the fall in prices. So it's little wonder then that we hear nothing but hysteria about deflation, which hurts the political and economic establishment the most, and only the mildest concern about inflation, which hurts everyone else. If I were the head of a highly leveraged firm and worried about my firm's ability to service its debt, or if I headed the Federal Reserve System, which consistently inflates away the dollar's purchasing power and gives the country higher prices than we would otherwise have faced, I too would want to portray deflation as an unthinkable disaster from which ongoing doses of inflation are meant to protect you. But deflation is not an economic problem, as we've seen. It's a political problem in that those parties that expect to be hurt by it seek to use the machinery of government and central banking to prevent it, or at least mitigate its effects. Now, it's true that a massive unanticipated deflation would cause widespread and undesirable disruption for a lot of business owners. Although, as we've seen, it need not interfere with overall production to any significant extent. But if that's your concern, then hard money becomes all the more desirable. Because the process of gold and silver mining is so time-consuming, and so increases in gold and silver coming onto the market are telegraphed well into the future, it is far easier to anticipate the future movement of the money supply under gold and silver than it is to anticipate how much money a central bank chairman might choose to create or destroy. Not to mention, the supply of gold and silver isn't going anywhere. It's not subject to sudden drops the way paper money is. All the gold and silver that have ever been mined is still available somewhere on the Earth's surface. The supply of paper money, precisely because it can be created at will and in any amount out of thin air, fluctuates wildly in supply when compared to the relatively stable supply of gold and silver. So sudden crashes involving massive drops in the supply of money do not occur in a hard money system. All right, folks, before we carry on with more subversion, let me remind you, especially you men, to get you some credit as a hopeless romantic. I want to remind you of something you can do in your relationship that will make it more robust and enjoyable and intimate and fun, and that is to subscribe, as I do and I have for several years now, to the Happily Date Box subscription service. Every month, you get a wonderful surprise in a box delivered to you that amounts to a stay-at-home date with your significant other, who maybe sometimes things get busy and you haven't gone out in a while. And the Happily Date Box comes to the rescue. You open it up, there's a music playlist in there, there's some theme, some questions you ask each other that are not usually the kinds of questions you ask each other. So you get to know some additional little aspect of your significant other. There's sometimes there's a game to play. There's a little project in the kitchen. There's a craft to do. Whatever it is, there's a bunch of things, usually three or four different things to make for a wonderful evening together. And don't you want your partner to say to you, wow, that's amazing that you thought to do this. This is a wonderful thing for the two of us. It's going to help us grow our relationship and help it flourish. And it is so thoughtful of you to have done this. Don't you want to be told that? Who doesn't want to be told that? Okay? You want to be told that. Here's how to be told that. Go to tomwoods.com/date and take 50% off your first date if you go to that link. So tomwoods.com/date, get 50% off your first date. And I'm telling you, you're going to look forward every month. You say, ah, good, the Happily Box arrived. It's a great way to connect even during really busy times. So check it out, tomwoods.com/date. All right, back to what we're talking about here. If you talk about the gold standard, let's say, now look, I know there's Bitcoin these days, and that's a separate question. But the arguments against the gold standard were never any good. They were always bad. It's simply ridiculed most of the time. And usually arguments aren't even raised against it, or they just say things about it that are just flat out wrong. The United States rose to become the greatest industrial power in the world under a hard money and under falling prices. So, you know, there's no refuting that. It's like with COVID. There's no refuting that after you adjust for age, Florida did better than most states when it came to COVID mortality. So I don't care what they say. They can come up with a million different claims. That one shoots them all down. And this one shoots these all down, who say it's stupid, it's backward, it's not sophisticated like our wonderful system of today or whatever. Ludwig von Mises explained once why it is that the powers that be are so critical of the gold standard. And so this is a lengthy passage, but I think it's worth reading. Mises says, the eminence of the gold standard consists in the fact that it makes the determination of the monetary unit's purchasing power independent of the measures of governments. It wrests from the hands of the economic czars their most redoubtable instrument. It makes it impossible for them to inflate. This is why the gold standard is furiously attacked by all those who expect that they will be benefited by bounties from the seemingly inexhaustible government purse. What is needed, first of all, he continues, is to force the rulers to spend only what, by virtue of duly promulgated laws, they have collected as taxes. No back door must be left open where inflation can slip in. No emergency can justify a return to inflation. Inflation can provide neither the weapons a nation needs to defend its independence nor the capital goods required for any project. It does not cure unsatisfactory conditions. It merely helps the rulers whose policies brought about the catastrophe to exculpate themselves. One of the goals of the reform suggested, which is, this is again Mises, and he's talking about return to sound money, is to explode and to kill forever the superstitious belief that governments and banks have the power to make the nation or individual citizens richer out of nothing and without making anybody poorer. The short-sighted observer sees only the things the government has accomplished by spending the newly created money. He does not see the things, the non-performance of which, provided the means for the government's success. He fails to realize that inflation does not create additional goods, but merely shifts wealth and income from some groups of people to others. Well, then some people say, well, we can't talk about money because it's not politically feasible to do anything about it. And F.A. Hayek warned us about this problem of excessively obsessing about political feasibility. He says, if there's a group out there that is overwhelmingly concerned about political feasibility, then it's never going to influence public opinion. It will simply be steamrolled by events. So here's what Hayek says. What we lack is a program which seems neither a mere defense of things as they are, nor a diluted kind of socialism, but a truly liberal radicalism which does not spare the susceptibilities of the mighty, which is not too severely practical, and which does not confine itself to what appears today as politically possible. We need intellectual leaders who are willing to work for an ideal, however small may be the prospects of its early realization. They must be men who are willing to stick to principles and to fight for their full realization, however remote. Those who have concerned themselves exclusively with what seemed practicable in the existing state of opinion have constantly found that even this had rapidly become politically impossible as the result of changes in a public opinion which they have done nothing to guide. And of course, how do issues become politically viable in the first place? Because they're talked about. The left got all kinds of things that would have seemed hopeless a generation earlier, passed and made part of normal American life by discussing them almost obsessively. And so when we think about those timid free market economists who supported various aspects of the Wall Street bailouts after 2008 on the grounds that this particular measure was the best of the politically viable options, well, maybe other options would have been politically viable if cowardly economists had helped to shape the debate by telling the truth. Or how about this, defending the free market and then just letting the chips fall where they may instead of just meekly acquiescing in mainstream opinion. Now, I've got more I want to say about the Fed. I want to give an overview of the main damage the Fed does, which I think comes in the form of the business cycle. You know, I've had a lot of episodes where I'll make some reference to the Austrian theory of the business cycle and say, oh yeah, I've got some episode on it. But I want to do a really thorough one, one that answers people's anticipated objections and spells it out much more clearly than artificially low interest rates make things unsustainable. Exactly how? What exactly is unsustainable about it? So I am going to do that in a future episode. But tomorrow, as I say, before the topic gets too stale, I want to get to the Supreme Court and talk about what's been going on. I mean, I have to talk current events when they are as momentous as the events of recent days. So I will get to that next time. In the meantime, if you like old Woods here and what he's up to on the Tom Woods Show, then you belong in the Tom Woods Show elite, which is one of the zillions of benefits you get when you support the Tom Woods Show and make its continued production possible. You can do that over at supportinglisteners.com. Let me know you're out there, warm my heart, and take your place among the cream of the crop in this community. Supportinglisteners.com. Thanks for listening.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.